over, even as Jobs kept reassuring her that he understood and that things had turned out just fine. Once she calmed down, she told Jobs that he had a full sister, Mona Simpson, who was then an aspiring novelist in Manhattan. She had never told Mona that she had a brother, and that day she broke the news, or at least part of it, by telephone. "You have a brother, and he's wonderful, and he's famous, and I'm going to bring him to New York so you can meet him," she said. Mona was in the throes of finishing a novel about her mother and their peregrination from Wisconsin to Los Angeles, anywhere but here. Those who've read it will not be surprised that Joanne was somewhat quirky in the way she imparted to Mona the news about her brother. She refused to say who he was, only that he had been poor, had gotten rich, was good-looking and famous, had long, dark hair, and lived in California. Mona then worked at the Paris Review, George Plimpton's literary journal housed on the ground floor of his townhouse near Manhattan's East River. She and her co-workers began a guessing game on who her brother might be. John Travolta? That was one of the favorite guesses. Other actors were also hot prospects. At one point, someone did toss out a guess that maybe it's one of those guys who started Apple Computer, but no one could recall their names. The meeting occurred in the lobby of the St. Regis Hotel. "He was totally straightforward and lovely. Just a normal and sweet guy," Mona recalled. They all sat and talked for a few minutes. Then he took his sister for a long walk, just the two of them. Jobs was thrilled to find that he had a sibling who was so similar to him. They were both intense in their artistry, observant of their surroundings, and sensitive yet strong-willed. When they went to dinner together, they noticed the same architectural details and talked about them excitedly afterward. "My sister's a writer," he exulted to colleagues at Apple when he found out. When Plimpton threw a party for Anywhere But Here in late 1986, Jobs flew to New York to accompany Mona to it. They grew increasingly close, though their friendship had the complexities that might be expected, considering who they were and how they had come together. Mona was not completely thrilled at first to have me in her life and have her mother so emotionally affectionate toward me, he later said. "As we got to know each other, we became really good friends, and she is my family. I don't know what I'd do without her. I can't imagine a better sister. My adopted sister, Patty, and I were never close." Mona likewise developed a deep affection for him, and at times could be very protective, although she would later write an edgy novel about him, a regular guy, that described his quirks with discomforting accuracy. One of the few things they would argue about was her clothes. She dressed like a struggling novelist, and he would berate her for not wearing clothes that were fetching enough. At one point, his comments so annoyed her that she wrote him a letter. "I am a young writer, and this is my life, and I'm not trying to be a model anyway." He didn't answer. But shortly after, a box arrived from the store of Issey Miyake, the Japanese fashion designer whose stark and technology-influenced style made him one of Jobs's favorites. "He'd gone shopping for me," she later said, "and he'd picked out great things, exactly my size, in flattering colors." There was one pantsuit that he had particularly liked, and the shipment included three of them, all identical. "I still remember those first suits I sent Mona," he said. "They were linen pants and tops in a pale grayish green that looked beautiful with her reddish hair." The Lost Father. In the meantime, Mona Simpson had been trying to track down their father, who had wandered off when she was five. Through Ken Auletta and Nick Pileggi, prominent Manhattan writers, she was introduced to a retired New York cop who had formed his own detective agency. "I paid him what little money I had," Simpson recalled, "but the search was unsuccessful." Then she met another private eye in California, who was able to find an address for Abdul Fattah Jandali in Sacramento through a Department of Motor Vehicle search. Simpson told her brother and flew out from New York to see the man who was apparently their father. Jobs had no interest in meeting him. "He didn't treat me well," he later explained. "I don't hold anything against him. I'm happy to be alive. But what bothers me most is that he didn't treat Mona well. He abandoned her." Jobs himself had abandoned his own illegitimate daughter, Lisa, and now was trying to restore their relationship. But that complexity did not soften his feelings toward Jandali. Simpson went to Sacramento alone. "It was very intense," Simpson recalled. She found her father working in a small restaurant. He seemed happy to see her, yet oddly passive about the entire situation. They talked for a few hours, and he recounted that after he left Wisconsin, he had drifted away from teaching and gotten into the restaurant business. Jobs had asked Simpson not to mention him, so she didn't. But at one point, her father casually remarked that he and her mother had had another baby, a boy, before she had been born. "What happened to him?" she asked. He replied, "We'll never see that baby again. That baby's gone." Simpson recoiled, but said nothing. An even more astonishing revelation occurred when Jandali was describing the previous restaurants that he had run. There had been some nice ones, he insisted, fancier than the Sacramento joint they were then sitting in. He told her somewhat emotionally that he wished she could have seen him when he was managing a Mediterranean restaurant north of San Jose. "That was a wonderful place," he said. "All of the successful technology people used to come there. Even Steve Jobs." Simpson was stunned. "Oh yeah, he used to come in. And he was a sweet guy, and a big tipper," her father added. Mona was able to refrain from blurting out, "Steve Jobs is your son." When the visit was over, she called Jobs surreptitiously from the payphone at the restaurant and arranged to meet him at the Espresso Roma Cafe in Berkeley. Adding to the personal and family drama, he brought along Lisa, now in grade school, who lived with her mother, Chris Ann. When they all arrived at the cafe, it was close to 10 p.m., and Simpson poured forth the tale. Jobs was understandably astonished when she mentioned the restaurant near San Jose. He could recall being there and even meeting the man who was his biological father. "It was amazing," he later said of the revelation. "I had been to that restaurant a few times, and I remember meeting the owner. He was Syrian, balding. We shook hands." Nevertheless, Jobs still had no desire to see him. "I was a wealthy man by then, and I didn't trust him not to try to blackmail me or go to the press about it," he recalled. "I asked Mona not to tell him about me." She never did. But years later, Jandali saw his relationship to Jobs mentioned online. A blogger noticed that Simpson had listed Jandali as her father in a reference book and figured out he must be Jobs's father as well. By then, Jandali was married for a fourth time and working as a food and beverage manager at the Boomtown Resort and Casino just west of Reno, Nevada. When he brought his new wife to visit Simpson in 2006, he raised the topic. "What is this thing about Steve Jobs?" he asked her. She confirmed the story, but added that she thought Jobs had no interest in meeting him. Jandali seemed to accept that. "My father is thoughtful and a beautiful storyteller, but he is very, very passive," Simpson said. "He never contacted Steve." Simpson turned her search for Jandali into a basis for her second novel, The Lost Father, published in 1992. Jobs convinced Paul Rand, the designer who did the Next logo, to design the cover, but according to Simpson, it was god-awful and we never used it. She also tracked down various members of the Jandali family, in Homs and in America, and in 2011 was writing a novel about her Syrian roots. The Syrian ambassador in Washington threw a dinner for her that included a cousin and his wife who then lived in Florida and had flown up for the occasion. Simpson assumed that Jobs would eventually meet Jundali, but as time went on, he showed even less interest. In 2010, when Jobs and his son, Reed, went to a birthday dinner for Simpson at her Los Angeles house, Reed spent some time looking at pictures of his biological grandfather, but Jobs ignored them. Nor did he seem to care about his Syrian heritage. When the Middle East would come up in conversation, the topic did not engage him or evoke his typical strong opinions. Even after Syria was swept up in the 2011 Arab Spring uprisings, "I don't think anybody really knows what we should be doing over there," he said, when I asked whether the Obama administration should be intervening more in Egypt, Libya, and Syria. "You're fucked if you do, and you're fucked if you don't." Jobs did retain a friendly relationship with his biological mother, Joanne Simpson. Over the years, she and Mona would often spend Christmas at Jobs's house. The visits could be sweet, but also emotionally draining. Joanne would sometimes break into tears, say how much she had loved him, and apologize for giving him up. "It turned out all right," Jobs would reassure her. As he told her one Christmas, "Don't worry. I had a great childhood. I turned out okay." Lisa. Lisa Brennan, however, did not have a great childhood. When she was young, her father almost never came to see her. "I didn't want to be a father, so I wasn't," Jobs later said, with only a touch of remorse in his voice. Yet occasionally he felt the tug. One day when Lisa was three, Jobs was driving near the house he had bought for her and Chris Ann, and he decided to stop. Lisa didn't know who he was. He sat on the doorstep, not venturing inside, and talked to Chris Ann. The scene was repeated once or twice a year. Jobs would come by unannounced, talk a little bit about Lisa's school options or other issues, then drive off in his Mercedes. But by the time Lisa turned 8 in 1986, the visits were occurring more frequently. Jobs was no longer immersed in the grueling push to create the Macintosh or the subsequent power struggles with Scully. He was at Next, which was calmer, friendlier, and headquartered in Palo Alto, near where Chris Ann and Lisa lived. In addition, by the time she was in third grade, it was clear that Lisa was a smart and artistic kid, who had already been singled out by her teachers for her writing ability. She was spunky and high-spirited, and had a little of her father's defiant attitude. She also looked a bit like him, with arched eyebrows and a faintly Middle Eastern angularity. One day, to the surprise of his colleagues, he brought her by the office. As she turned cartwheels in the corridor, she squealed, "Look at me!" Avi Tavanian, a lanky and gregarious engineer at Next who had become Jobs's friend, remembers that every now and then, when they were going out to dinner, they would stop by Chris Ann's house to pick up Lisa. "He was very sweet to her," Tavanian recalled. "He was a vegetarian, and so was Chris Ann, but she wasn't. He was fine with that. He suggested she order chicken, and she did." Eating chicken became her little indulgence as she shuttled between two parents who were vegetarians with a spiritual regard for natural foods. "We bought our groceries, our punterella, quinoa, celeriac, carob-covered nuts, in yeasty-smelling stores where the women didn't dye their hair," she later wrote about her time with her mother. "But we sometimes tasted foreign treats. A few times we bought a hot, seasoned chicken from a gourmet shop with rows and rows of chickens turning on spits, and ate it in the car from the foil-lined paper bag with our fingers." Her father, whose dietary fixations came in fanatic waves, was more fastidious about what he ate. She watched him spit out a mouthful of soup one day after learning that it contained butter. After loosening up a bit while at Apple, he was back to being a strict vegan. Even at a young age, Lisa began to realize his diet obsessions reflected a life philosophy, one in which asceticism, and minimalism could heighten subsequent sensations. He believed that great harvests came from arid sources, pleasure from restraint, she noted. He knew the equations that most people didn't know. Things led to their opposites. In a similar way, the absence and coldness of her father made his occasional moments of warmth so much more intensely gratifying. I didn't live with him, but he would stop by our house some days, a deity among us for a few tingling moments or hours, she recalled. Lisa soon became interested enough that he would take walks with her. He would also go rollerblading with her on the quiet streets of old Palo Alto, often stopping at the houses of Joanna Hoffman and Andy Hertzfeld. The first time he brought her around to see Hoffman, he just knocked on the door and announced, "This is Lisa." Hoffman knew right away. It was obvious she was his daughter, she told me. Nobody has that jaw. It's a signature jaw. Hoffman, who suffered from not knowing her own divorced father until she was 10, encouraged Jobs to be a better father. He followed her advice and later thanked her for it. Once he took Lisa on a business trip to Tokyo, and they stayed at the sleek and businesslike Okura Hotel. At the elegant downstairs sushi bar, Jobs ordered large trays of unagi sushi, a dish he loved so much that he allowed the warm-cooked eel to pass muster as vegetarian. The pieces were coated with fine salt or a thin sweet sauce, and Lisa remembered later how they dissolved in her mouth. So too did the distance between them. As she later wrote, "It was the first time I'd felt with him so relaxed and content over those trays of meat. The excess, the permission and warmth after the cold salads, meant a once inaccessible space had opened. He was less rigid with himself, even human, under the great ceilings with the little chairs, with the meat, and me." But it was not always sweetness and light. Jobs was as mercurial with Lisa as he was with almost everyone, cycling between embrace and abandonment. On one visit he would be playful, on the next he would be cold. Often he was not there at all. She was always unsure of their relationship, according to Hertzfeld. "I went to a birthday party of hers, and Steve was supposed to come, and he was very, very late. She got extremely anxious and disappointed. But when he finally did come, she totally lit up." Lisa learned to be temperamental in return. Over the years, their relationship would be a roller coaster, with each of the low points elongated by their shared stubbornness. After a falling out, they could go for months not speaking to each other. Neither one was good at reaching out, apologizing, or making the effort to heal, even when he was wrestling with repeated health problems. One day in the fall of 2010, he was wistfully going through a box of old snapshots with me and paused over one that showed him visiting Lisa when she was young. "I probably didn't go over there enough," he said. Since he had not spoken to her all that year, I asked if he might want to reach out to her with a call or email. He looked at me blankly for a moment, then went back to riffling through other old photographs. The romantic. When it came to women, Jobs could be deeply romantic. He tended to fall in love dramatically, share with friends every up and down of a relationship, and pine in public whenever he was away from his current girlfriend. In the summer of 1983, he went to a small dinner party in Silicon Valley with Joan Baez and sat next to an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania named Jennifer Egan, who was not quite sure who he was. By then, he and Baez had realized that they weren't destined to be forever young together, and Jobs found himself fascinated by Egan, who was working on a San Francisco weekly during her summer vacation. He tracked her down, gave her a call, and took her to Café Jacqueline, a little bistro near Telegraph Hill that specialized in vegetarian soufflés. They dated for a year, and Jobs often flew east to visit her. At a Boston Macworld event, he told a large gathering how much in love he was, and thus needed to rush out to catch a plane for Philadelphia to see his girlfriend. The audience was enchanted. When he was visiting New York, she would take the train up to stay with him at the Carlyle or at Jay Shiat's Upper East Side apartment, and they would eat at Café Luxembourg. Visit, repeatedly, the apartment in the San Remo he was planning to remodel, and go to movies, or, once at least, the opera. He and Egan also spoke for hours on the phone many nights. One topic they wrestled with was his belief, which came from his Buddhist studies, that it was important to avoid attachment to material objects. "Our consumer desires are unhealthy," he told her, "and to attain enlightenment, you need to develop a life of non-attachment and non-materialism." He even sent her a tape of Koben Chino, his Zen teacher, lecturing about the problems caused by craving and obtaining things. Egan pushed back. "Wasn't he defying that philosophy," she asked, "by making computers and other products that people coveted?" He was irritated by the dichotomy, and we had exuberant debates about it, Egan recalled. In the end, Jobs's pride in the objects he made overcame his sensibility that people should eschew being attached to such possessions. When the Macintosh came out in January 1984, Egan was staying at her mother's apartment in San Francisco during her winter break from Penn. Her mother's dinner guests were astonished one night when Steve Jobs, suddenly very famous, appeared at the door, carrying a freshly boxed Macintosh, and proceeded to Egan's bedroom to set it up. Jobs told Egan, as he had a few other friends, about his premonition that he would not live a long life. That was why he was driven and impatient, he confided. He felt a sense of urgency about all he wanted to get done, Egan later said. Their relationship tapered off by the fall of 1984, when Egan made it clear that she was still far too young to think of getting married. Shortly after that, just as the turmoil with Scully was beginning to build at Apple in early 1985, Jobs was heading to a meeting when he stopped at the office of a guy who was working with the Apple Foundation, which helped get computers to nonprofit organizations. Sitting in his office was a lithe, very blonde woman who combined a hippie aura of natural purity with the solid sensibilities of a computer consultant. Her name was Tina Redsey. "She was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen," Jobs recalled. He called her the next day and asked her to dinner. She said no, that she was living with a boyfriend. A few days later, he took her on a walk to a nearby park and again asked her out, and this time she told her boyfriend that she wanted to go. She was very honest and open. After dinner, she started to cry because she knew her life was about to be disrupted, and it was. Within a few months, she had moved into the unfurnished mansion in Woodside. "She was the first person I was truly in love with," Jobs later said. "We had a very deep connection. I don't know that anyone will ever understand me better than she did." Redsey came from a troubled family, and Jobs shared with her his own pain about being put up for adoption. "We were both wounded from our childhood," Redsey recalled. "He said to me that we were misfits, which is why we belonged together." They were physically passionate and prone to public displays of affection. Their make-out sessions in the next lobby are well remembered by employees. So too were their fights, which occurred at movie theaters and in front of visitors to Woodside. Yet he constantly praised her purity and naturalness. As the well-grounded Joanna Hoffman pointed out when discussing Jobs's infatuation with the otherworldly Redsey, "Steve had a tendency to look at vulnerabilities and neuroses and turn them into spiritual attributes." When he was being eased out at Apple in 1985, Redsey traveled with him in Europe, where he was salving his wounds. Standing on a bridge over the Seine one evening, they bandied about the idea, more romantic than serious, of just staying in France maybe settling down, perhaps indefinitely. Redsea was eager, but Jobs didn't want to. He was burned, but still ambitious. "I am a reflection of what I do," he told her. She recalled their Paris moment in a poignant email she sent to him 25 years later, after they had gone their separate ways but retained their spiritual connection. "We were on a bridge in Paris in the summer of 1985. It was overcast. We leaned against the smooth stone rail and stared at the green water rolling on below. Your world had cleaved, and then it paused, waiting to rearrange itself around whatever you chose next. I wanted to run away from what had come before. I tried to convince you to begin a new life with me in Paris, to shed our former selves and let something else course through us. I wanted us to crawl through that black chasm of your broken world and emerge, anonymous and new, in simple lives where I could cook you simple dinners, and we could be together every day, like children playing a sweet game with no purpose save the game itself. I like to think you considered it, before you laughed and said, 'What could I do? I've made myself unemployable.' I like to think that in that moment's hesitation, before our bold futures reclaimed us, we lived that simple life together, all the way into our peaceful old ages, with a brood of grandchildren around us on a farm in the south of France, quietly going about our days, warm and complete, like loaves of fresh bread, our small world filled with the aroma of patience and familiarity." The relationship lurched up and down for 5 years. Redsea hated living in his sparsely furnished woodside house. Jobs had hired a hip young couple who had once worked at Chez Panisse as housekeepers and vegetarian cooks, and they made her feel like an interloper. She would occasionally move out to an apartment of her own in Palo Alto, especially after one of her torrential arguments with Jobs. "Neglect is a form of abuse," she once scrawled on the wall of the hallway to their bedroom. She was entranced by him, but she was also baffled by how uncaring he could be. She would later recall how incredibly painful it was to be in love with someone so self-centered. Caring deeply about someone who seemed incapable of caring was a particular kind of hell that she wouldn't wish on anyone, she said. They were different in so many ways. On the spectrum of cruel to kind, they are close to the opposite poles, Hertzfeld later said. Redsea's kindness was manifest in ways large and small. She always gave money to street people. She volunteered to help those who, like her father, were afflicted with mental illness, and she took care to make Lisa and even Chrisanne feel comfortable with her. More than anyone, she helped persuade Jobs to spend more time with Lisa, but she lacked Jobs's ambition and drive. The ethereal quality that made her seem so spiritual to Jobs also made it hard for them to stay on the same wavelength. Their relationship was incredibly tempestuous, said Hertzfeld. Because of both of their characters, they would have lots and lots of fights. They also had a basic philosophical difference about whether aesthetic tastes were fundamentally individual, as Redsea believed, or universal and could be taught, as Jobs believed. She accused him of being too influenced by the Bauhaus movement. Steve believed it was our job to teach people aesthetics, to teach people what they should like, she recalled. I don't share that perspective. I believe when we listen deeply, both within ourselves and to each other, we are able to allow what's innate and true to emerge. When they were together for a long stretch, things did not work out well. But when they were apart, Jobs would pine for her. Finally, in the summer of 1989, he asked her to marry him. She couldn't do it. It would drive her crazy, she told friends. She had grown up in a volatile household, and her relationship with Jobs bore too many similarities to that environment. They were opposites who attracted, she said, but the combination was too combustible. I could not have been a good wife to Steve Jobs, the icon, she later explained. I would have sucked at it on many levels. In our personal interactions, I couldn't abide his unkindness. I didn't want to hurt him, yet I didn't want to stand by and watch him hurt other people either. It was painful and exhausting. After they broke up, Redsea helped found Open Mind, a mental health resource network in California. She happened to read in a psychiatric manual about narcissistic personality disorder and decided that Jobs perfectly met the criteria. It fits so well and explains so much of what we had struggled with that I realized expecting him to be nicer or less self-centered was like expecting a blind man to see, she said. It also explained some of the choices he'd made about his daughter Lisa at that time. I think the issue is empathy. The capacity for empathy is lacking. Redsea later married, had two children, and then divorced. Every now and then Jobs would openly pine for her, even after he was happily married. And when he began his battle with cancer, she got in touch again to give support. She became very emotional whenever she recalled their relationship. Though our values clashed and made it impossible for us to have the relationship we once hoped for, she told me, the care and love I felt for him decades ago has continued. Similarly, Jobs suddenly started to cry one afternoon as he sat in his living room reminiscing about her. She was one of the purest people I've ever known, he said, tears rolling down his cheeks. There was something spiritual about her, and spiritual about the connection we had. He said he always regretted that they could not make it work, and he knew that she had such regrets as well, but it was not meant to be. On that, they both agreed. Chapter 21. Family Man. At Home with the Jobs Clan. Laureen Powell. By this point, based on his dating history, a matchmaker could have put together a composite sketch of the woman who would be right for Jobs. Smart, yet unpretentious. Tough enough to stand up to him, yet zen-like enough to rise above turmoil. Well-educated and independent, yet ready to make accommodations for him and a family. Down to earth, but with a touch of the ethereal. Savvy enough to know how to manage him, but secure enough to not always need to. And it wouldn't hurt to be a beautiful, lanky blonde with an easygoing sense of humor who liked organic vegetarian food. In October 1989, after his split with Tina Redsea, just such a woman walked into his life. More specifically, just such a woman walked into his classroom. Jobs had agreed to give one of the View from the Top lectures at the Stanford Business School one Thursday evening. Laureen Powell was a new graduate student at the business school, and a guy in her class talked her into going to the lecture. They arrived late, and all the seats were taken, so they sat in the aisle. When an usher told them they had to move, Powell took her friend down to the front row and commandeered two of the reserved seats there. Jobs was led to the one next to her when he arrived. I looked to my right, and there was a beautiful girl there, so we started chatting while I was waiting to be introduced, Jobs recalled. They bantered a bit, and Laureen joked that she was sitting there because she had won a raffle, and the prize was that he got to take her to dinner. He was so adorable, she later said. After the speech, Jobs hung around on the edge of the stage chatting with students. He watched Powell leave, then come back and stand at the edge of the crowd, then leave again. He bolted out after her, brushing past the dean who was trying to grab him for a conversation. After catching up with her in the parking lot, he said, "Excuse me, wasn't there something about a raffle you won that I'm supposed to take you to dinner?" She laughed. "How about Saturday?" he asked. She agreed and wrote down her number. Jobs headed to his car to drive up to the Thomas Fogarty Winery in the Santa Cruz Mountains above Woodside, where the Next Education sales group was holding a dinner. But he suddenly stopped and turned around. I thought, wow, I'd rather have dinner with her than the education group. So I ran back to her car and said, how about dinner tonight? She said yes. It was a beautiful fall evening, and they walked into Palo Alto to a funky vegetarian restaurant, St. Michael's Alley, and ended up staying there for 4 hours. We've been together ever since, he said. Avi Tavanian was sitting at the winery restaurant waiting with the rest of the Next Education group. Steve was sometimes unreliable, but when I talked to him, I realized that something special had come up, he said. As soon as Powell got home after midnight, she called her close friend, Catherine Cat Smith, who was at Berkeley, and left a message on her machine. You will not believe what just happened to me, it said. You will not believe who I met. Smith called back the next morning and heard the tale. We had known about Steve, and he was a person of interest to us, because we were business students, she recalled. Andy Hertzfeld and a few others later speculated that Powell had been scheming to meet Jobs. Laureen is nice, but she can be calculating, and I think she targeted him from the beginning, Hertzfeld said. Her college roommate told me that Laureen had magazine covers of Steve and vowed she was going to meet him. If it's true that Steve was manipulated, there is a fair amount of irony there. But Powell later insisted that wasn't the case. She went only because her friend wanted to go, and she was slightly confused as to who they were going to see. I knew that Steve Jobs was the speaker, but the face I thought of was that of Bill Gates, she recalled. I had them mixed up. This was 1989. He was working at Next, and he was not that big of a deal to me. I wasn't that enthused, but my friend was, so we went. There were only two women in my life that I was truly in love with, Tina and Laureen, Jobs later said. I thought I was in love with Joan Baez, but I really just liked her a lot. It was just Tina, and then Laureen. Laureen Powell had been born in New Jersey in 1963 and had learned to be self-sufficient at an early age. Her father was a Marine Corps pilot who died a hero in a crash in Santa Ana, California. He had been leading a crippled plane in for a landing, and when it hit his plane, he kept flying to avoid a residential area rather than ejecting in time to save his life. Her mother's second marriage turned out to be a horrible situation, but she felt she couldn't leave because she had no means to support her large family. For 10 years, Laureen and her three brothers had to suffer in a tense household, keeping a good demeanor while compartmentalizing problems. She did well. The lesson I learned was clear, that I always wanted to be self-sufficient, she said. I took pride in that. My relationship with money is that it's a tool to be self-sufficient, but it's not something that is part of who I am. After graduating from the University of Pennsylvania, she worked at Goldman Sachs as a fixed-income trading strategist, dealing with enormous sums of money that she traded for the house account. John Corzine, her boss, tried to get her to stay at Goldman, but instead she decided the work was unedifying. You could be really successful, she said, but you're just contributing to capital formation. So after 3 years, she quit and went to Florence, Italy, living there for 8 months before enrolling in Stanford Business School. After their Thursday night dinner, she invited Jobs over to her Palo Alto apartment on Saturday. Cat Smith drove down from Berkeley and pretended to be her roommate so she could meet him as well. She recalled that their relationship became very passionate. They would kiss and make out, Smith said. He was enraptured with her. He would call me on the phone and ask, "What do you think? Does she like me?" Here I am in this bizarre position of having this iconic person call me. That New Year's Eve of 1989, the three went to Chez Panisse, the famed Alice Waters restaurant in Berkeley, along with Lisa, then 11. Something happened at the dinner that caused Jobs and Powell to start arguing. They left separately, and Powell ended up spending the night at Cat Smith's apartment. At 9 the next morning, there was a knock at the door, and Smith opened it to find Jobs standing in the drizzle, holding some wildflowers he had picked. "May I come in and see Loreen?" he said. She was still asleep, and he walked into the bedroom. A couple of hours went by, while Smith waited in the living room, unable to go in and get her clothes. Finally, she put a coat on over her nightgown and went to Pete's Coffee to pick up some food. Jobs did not emerge until after noon. "Cat, can you come here for a minute?" he asked. They all gathered in the bedroom. "As you know, Loreen's father passed away, and Loreen's mother isn't here. And since you're her best friend, I'm going to ask you the question," he said. "I'd like to marry Loreen. Will you give your blessing?" Smith clambered onto the bed and thought about it. "Is this okay with you?" she asked Powell. When she nodded yes, Smith announced, "Well, there's your answer." It was not, however, a definitive answer. Jobs had a way of focusing on something with insane intensity for a while, and then, abruptly, turning away his gaze. At work, he would focus on what he wanted to, when he wanted to, and on other matters he would be unresponsive, no matter how hard people tried to get him to engage. In his personal life, he was the same way. At times, he and Powell would indulge in public displays of affection that were so intense they embarrassed everyone in their presence, including Cat Smith and Powell's mother. In the mornings at his Woodside mansion, he would wake Powell up by blasting the Fine Young Cannibals' "She Drives Me Crazy" on his tape deck. Yet at other times, he would ignore her. Steve would fluctuate between intense focus, where she was the center of the universe, to being coldly distant and focused on work, said Smith. He had the power to focus like a laser beam, and when it came across you, you basked in the light of his attention. When it moved to another point of focus, it was very, very dark for you. It was very confusing to Loreen. Once she had accepted his marriage proposal on the first day of 1990, he didn't mention it again for several months. Finally, Smith confronted him while they were sitting on the edge of a sandbox in Palo Alto. What was going on? Jobs replied that he needed to feel sure that Powell could handle the life he lived and the type of person he was. In September, she became fed up with waiting and moved out. The following month, he gave her a diamond engagement ring, and she moved back in. In December, Jobs took Powell to his favorite vacation spot, Kona Village in Hawaii. He had started going there 9 years earlier, when, stressed out at Apple, he had asked his assistant to pick out a place for him to escape. At first glance, he didn't like the cluster of sparse, thatched-roof bungalows nestled on a beach on the Big Island of Hawaii. It was a family resort with communal eating. But within hours, he had begun to view it as paradise. There was a simplicity and spare beauty that moved him, and he returned whenever he could. He especially enjoyed being there that December with Powell. Their love had matured. The night before Christmas, he again declared, even more formally, that he wanted to marry her. Soon another factor would drive that decision. While in Hawaii, Powell got pregnant. "We know exactly where it happened," Jobs later said with a laugh. The Wedding, March 18, 1991. Powell's pregnancy did not completely settle the issue. Jobs again began balking at the idea of marriage, even though he had dramatically proposed to her both at the very beginning and the very end of 1990. Furious, she moved out of his house and back to her apartment. For a while he sulked or ignored the situation. Then he thought he might still be in love with Tina Redsea, He sent her roses and tried to convince her to return to him, maybe even get married. He was not sure what he wanted, and he surprised a wide swath of friends and even acquaintances by asking them what he should do. Who was prettier, he would ask, Tina or Laureen? Who did they like better? Who should he marry? In a chapter about this in Mona Simpson's novel A Regular Guy, the Jobs character asked more than 100 people who they thought was more beautiful. But that was fiction. In reality, it was probably fewer than 100. He ended up making the right choice. As Red Sea told friends, she never would have survived if she had gone back to Jobs, nor would their marriage. Even though he would pine about the spiritual nature of his connection to Red Sea, he had a far more solid relationship with Powell. He liked her. He loved her. He respected her, and he was comfortable with her. He may not have seen her as mystical, but she was a sensible anchor for his life. He is the luckiest guy to have landed with Laureen, who is smart and can engage him intellectually, and can sustain his ups and downs and tempestuous personality, said Joanna Hoffman. Because she's not neurotic, Steve may feel that she is not as mystical as Tina or something, but that's silly. Andy Hertzfeld agreed. Laureen looks a lot like Tina, but she is totally different because she is tougher and armor-plated. That's why the marriage works. Jobs understood this as well. Despite his emotional turbulence and occasional meanness, the marriage would turn out to be enduring, marked by loyalty and faithfulness, overcoming the ups and downs and jangling emotional complexities it encountered. Avi Tavanian decided Jobs needed a bachelor's party. This was not as easy as it sounded. Jobs did not like to party and didn't have a gang of male buddies. He didn't even have a best man. So the party turned out to be just Tavanian and Richard Crandall, a computer science professor at Reed, who had taken a leave to work at Next. Tavanian hired a limo, and when they got to Jobs' house, Powell answered the door dressed in a suit and wearing a fake mustache, saying that she wanted to come as one of the guys. It was just a joke, and soon the three bachelors, none of them drinkers, were rolling to San Francisco to see if they could pull off their own pale version of a bachelor party. Tavanian had been unable to get reservations at Green's, the vegetarian restaurant at Fort Mason that Jobs liked, so he booked a very fancy restaurant at a hotel. "I don't want to eat here," Jobs announced as soon as the bread was placed on the table. He made them get up and walk out, to the horror of Tavanian, who was not yet used to Jobs's restaurant manners. He led them to Café Jacqueline in North Beach, the soufflé place that he loved, which was indeed a better choice. Afterward, they took the limo across the Golden Gate Bridge to a bar in Sausalito, where all three ordered shots of tequila, but only sipped them. It was not great as bachelor parties go, but it was the best we could come up with for someone like Steve, and nobody else volunteered to do it, recalled Tavanian. Jobs was appreciative. He decided that he wanted Tavanian to marry his sister, Mona Simpson. Though nothing came of it, the thought was a sign of affection. Powell had fair warning of what she was getting into. As she was planning the wedding, the person who was going to do the calligraphy for the invitations came by the house to show them some options. There was no furniture for her to sit on, so she sat on the floor and laid out the samples. Jobs looked for a few minutes, then got up and left the room. They waited for him to come back, but he didn't. After a while, Powell went to find him in his room. "Get rid of her," he said. "I can't look at her stuff. It's shit." On March 18, 1991, Stephen Paul Jobs, 36, married Laureen Powell, 27, at the Awani Lodge in Yosemite National Park. Built in the 1920s, The Awani is a sprawling pile of stone, concrete, and timber designed in a style that mixed Art Deco, the arts and crafts movement, and the Park Service's love of huge fireplaces. Its best features are the views. It has floor-to-ceiling windows looking out on Half Dome and Yosemite Falls. About 50 people came, including Steve's father, Paul Jobs, and sister, Mona Simpson. She brought her fiancé, Richard Appel, a lawyer who went on to become a television comedy writer. As a writer for The Simpsons, he named Homer's mother after his wife. Jobs insisted that they all arrive by chartered bus. He wanted to control all aspects of the event. The ceremony was in the solarium, with the snow coming down hard and Glacier Point just visible in the distance. It was conducted by Jobs' longtime Soto Zen teacher, Koban Chino, who shook a stick, struck a gong, lit incense, and chanted in a mumbling manner that most guests found incomprehensible. "I thought he was drunk," said Tavanian. He wasn't. The wedding cake was in the shape of Half Dome, the granite crest at the end of Yosemite Valley, but since it was strictly vegan, devoid of eggs, milk, or any refined products, more than a few of the guests found it inedible. Afterward, they all went hiking, and Powell's three strapping brothers launched a snowball fight with lots of tackling and roughhousing. "You see, Mona," Jobs said to his sister, "Lorene is descended from Joe Namath, and we're descended from John Muir." A Family Home. Powell shared her husband's interest in natural foods. While at business school, she had worked part-time at Odwalla, the juice company, where she helped develop the first marketing plan. After marrying Jobs, she felt that it was important to have a career, having learned from her childhood the need to be self-sufficient. So she started her own company, Terra Vera, that made ready-to-eat organic meals and delivered them to stores throughout Northern California. Instead of living in the isolated and rather spooky, unfurnished Woodside mansion, the couple moved into a charming and unpretentious house on a corner in a family-friendly neighborhood in Old Palo Alto. It was a privileged realm. Neighbors would eventually include the visionary venture capitalist John Doerr, Google's founder Larry Page, and Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg, along with Andy Hertzfeld and Joanna Hoffman. But the homes were not ostentatious, and there were no high hedges or long drives shielding them from view. Instead, houses were nestled on lots next to each other along flat, quiet streets flanked by wide sidewalks. "We wanted to live in a neighborhood where kids could walk to see friends," Jobs later said. The house was not the minimalist and modernist style Jobs would have designed if he had built a home from scratch. Nor was it a large or distinctive mansion that would make people stop and take notice as they drove down his street in Palo Alto. It was built in the 1930s by a local designer named Carr Jones, who specialized in carefully crafted homes in the storybook style of English or French country cottages. The two-story house was made of red brick, with exposed wood beams and a shingle roof with curved lines. It evoked a rambling Cotswold cottage, or perhaps a home where a well-to-do hobbit might have lived. The one Californian touch was a mission-style courtyard framed by the wings of the house. The two-story vaulted-ceiling living room was informal, with a floor of tile and terracotta. At one end was a large triangular window leading up to the peak of the ceiling. It had stained glass when Jobs bought it, as if it were a chapel, but he replaced it with clear glass. The other renovation he and Powell made was to expand the kitchen to include a wood-burning pizza oven and room for a long wooden table that would become the family's primary gathering place. It was supposed to be a 4-month renovation, but it took 16 months because Jobs kept redoing the design. They also bought the small house behind them and raised it to make a backyard, which Powell turned into a beautiful natural garden filled with a profusion of seasonal flowers along with vegetables and herbs. Jobs became fascinated by the way Carr Jones relied on old material, including used bricks and wood from telephone poles, to provide a simple and sturdy structure. The beams in the kitchen had been used to make the molds for the concrete foundations of the Golden Gate Bridge, which was under construction when the house was built. He was a careful craftsman who was self-taught, Jobs said as he pointed out each of the details. He cared more about being inventive than about making money, and he never got rich. He never left California. His ideas came from reading books in the library and Architectural Digest. Jobs had never furnished his Woodside house beyond a few bare essentials, a chest of drawers and a mattress in his bedroom, a card table and some folding chairs in what would have been a dining room. He wanted around him only things that he could admire, and that made it hard simply to go out and buy a lot of furniture. Now that he was living in a normal neighborhood home with a wife and soon a child, he had to make some concessions to necessity. But it was hard. They got beds, dressers, and a music system for the living room, but items like sofas took longer. We spoke about furniture in theory for 8 years, recalled Powell. We spent a lot of time asking ourselves, what is the purpose of a sofa? Buying appliances was also a philosophical task, not just an impulse purchase. A few years later, Jobs described to Wired the process that went into getting a new washing machine. It turns out that the Americans make washers and dryers all wrong. The Europeans make them much better, but they take twice as long to do clothes. It turns out that they wash them with about a quarter as much water, and your clothes end up with a lot less detergent on them. Most important, they don't trash your clothes. They use a lot less soap, a lot less water, but they come out much cleaner, much softer, and they last a lot longer. We spend some time in our family talking about what's the trade-off we want to make. We ended up talking a lot about design, but also about the values of our family. Did we care most about getting our wash done in an hour versus an hour and a half? Or did we care most about our clothes feeling really soft and lasting longer? Did we care about using a quarter of the water? We spent about 2 weeks talking about this every night at the dinner table. They ended up getting a Miele washer and dryer made in Germany. I got more thrill out of them than I have out of any piece of high tech in years, Jobs said. The one piece of art that Jobs bought for the vaulted ceiling living room was an Ansel Adams print of the winter sunrise in the Sierra Nevada, taken from Lone Pine, California. Adams had made the huge mural print for his daughter, who later sold it. At one point, Jobs' housekeeper wiped it with a wet cloth, and Jobs tracked down a person who had worked with Adams to come to the house, strip it down a layer, and restore it. The house was so unassuming that Bill Gates was somewhat baffled when he visited with his wife. "Do all of you live here?" asked Gates, who was then in the process of building a 66,000-square-foot mansion near Seattle. Even when he had his second coming at Apple and was a world-famous billionaire, Jobs had no security guards or live-in servants, and he even kept the back door unlocked during the day. His only security problem came, sadly and strangely, from Burl Smith, the mop-headed cherubic Macintosh software engineer who had been Andy Hertzfeld's sidekick. After leaving Apple, Smith descended into schizophrenia. He lived in a house down the street from Hertzfeld, and as his disorder progressed, he began wandering the streets naked, at other times smashing the windows of cars and churches. He was put on strong medication, but it proved difficult to calibrate. At one point, when his demons returned, he began going over to the Jobs house in the evenings, throwing rocks through the windows, leaving rambling letters, and once tossing a firecracker into the house. He was arrested.